Jim Hill, welcome to KTNA. How is everything going so far on your visit to Talkeetna?
A little slick, but it's been going really well. I really love being back in the community.
Yeah. How long has it been since you were here last?
Oh, I think it's been about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And you spent a lot of time here in Talkeetna. Tell me about your experiences with town. How much
I first came here in 1974, so almost 40 years, 39 years ago, and when I was 20 years old. And to climb Denali and ended up guiding on Denali for Ray Genet way back when, one of the earlier guides, and then developed my own guide service and lived here and was in and out of here for a while. Moved here in 1980, ended up being pastor of a church here in town from 84 to 93. And so we've been in and out ever since, and then back and forth to visit since then.
There's an event at the library where you're going to discuss and show slides, I hope, of the Denali Hang Glider Expedition.
Yeah, actually, there's enough interest in it. We're going to be doing it at the elementary school rather than the library, but the library is sponsoring and trying to help put it together. So we'll be at the elementary school at 6 o'clock tonight, and I'll be showing slides from the 1976 Denali Hang Glider Expedition.
Where did this idea come from? Why hang gliders?
Well, you know, it was kind of a natural thing, really. I was born and raised there in Anchorage, and you know, you were around mountains all the time, and I was guiding and climbing, and then I got in together with a bunch of hang gliders, and it's a natural thing. We did a lot of climbing. We did a lot of helicopter things up to the tops of the mountains, and it was just a lot of exploration. So the natural thing, of course, is Denali is about as tall as a mountain gets around here, and so we started thinking that way. Strangely enough, it was such a common thing during that time that my wife was in a high school class in Anchorage in probably about 1970, and as part of one of her outdoor recreation classes, she and her friends actually developed an expedition plan to carry hang gliders to the top of Mount McKinley, and that's before we had ever really connected, and she and I had gotten married and all those various things. So it was kind of a natural progression of thought. It's just kind of logical. You know, it's a great big mountain and a fun idea to fly off of it.
How long did you guys prep for it? Was it, you know, just your standard expedition plus hang gliders or?
Yeah, no, it wasn't really all that standard in some ways, because once you get the kites involved in the whole process, that was a different thing. It was kind of standard, of course, in the sense of planning. We had to carry a lot more gear because it was going to take a longer time, and we were planning on carrying a camp clear to Archdeacon's Tower. We were going to, because just of waiting for proper weather to fly, put a dynamic in there that we weren't at all sure it was even going to happen. We figured the odds were about, well, maybe 1 in 4 days might be flyable. This is what my experience had been on the mountain before. So we did have a lot of extra gear, but the big thing was the kites. These were Dragonfly ultralights, and they were brand new. Hang gliding at the time was kind of like fishing with a club. The technology hadn't really been developed really well yet, and these were a new kite with a really much better glide ratio than the standard gliders of the day. But Ultralight Products, the company, was very slow in getting them together. They were almost prototypes. And so they only got to Anchorage just one day before we were leaving. So we were waiting and waiting. And then the guys got a chance to fly about 15 minutes on each one of those kites before they actually carried them up and jumped off Denali and those things. So that was a different dynamic for sure.
You mentioned the glide ratio. What sort of things do you look at with a high altitude hang gliding? Is it different than, you know, sea level hang gliding or anything like that?
Yeah, you know, that was a big question because no one had ever done this before. I mean, there were some balloon launches, but that wasn't really a clear thing. So the foot launching from that altitude or ski launching from that altitude was a big question because basically you'd need 15 miles or so an hour of speed to generate lift at sea level. But, you know, up there on top of Denali, you're dealing in the upper half of the Earth's atmosphere, so you have half again or less of wind resistance to create that lift. And so we really didn't know what was going to happen. So our plan was to ski launch. And so we just develop enough speed to be able to take off and then jettison the skis and go into your prone position and make the flight. But there were a lot of guesses as to what was going to happen with that. You know, the dynamics are all the same. So it wasn't, I didn't feel like it was an extreme risk, but we had a lot of people saying, are you sure you know what you're doing and whether those things are going to fly or not?
How long did you guys spend waiting for your weather window? Did it happen?
You know, that was an interesting thing because that year on Denali, the weather was pretty much perfect all season long. There were almost no storms. And so we had clear blue sky day after clear blue sky day. And so weather-wise, it was not, that wasn't really a factor at all. And so just trying to get the kites to the summit was the big factor. And once the kites were there, it was a day to fly. And so they flew the first guy off, Bob Burns, scraped a wingtip on the launch. They decided to try to foot launch, which was kind of harebrained. So they launched off the south face. Now, you know, we're looking at the south face here from Talkeetna, and that's 10,000 feet vertical straight down to the glacier below. You know, it's a kind of a big commitment. And so he takes off. He scrapes a wingtip on this little ridge coming off the summit, and the kite flies off sideways, kind of like flipping a card. So he goes into a flat spin, and he comes out of that. He's got a ham radio strapped to his arm, and he's broadcasting live to an Anchorage radio station. And he's going, oh man, I almost died. And so this is all getting broadcast live on AM radio. I can't remember the name of the station. But the second guy off saw this, rushed the launch, and caught his control bar on launch. He didn't have proper lift to fly, and bounced and rolled about 500, 600 feet down the south face through a bunch of rocks and ice. And the broken pieces of the kite jammed into the slope and stopped him, or he would have gone for a 10,000-foot ride. And so the other two guys, after they had to, we had to rescue that one. And so the other two guys came by a couple of days later when there was some wind, actually. And they actually took off and soared above the summit of Denali a couple of days later. So it was a long, stretched-out event. And the overall expedition was about 36 days. I think we set a record. The Park Service told us that we set a record for a number of man days on the mountain in any expedition, just because we had 12 of us. And had 36 days basically waiting here in town for whether to fly up, and then 30 days on the mountain.
Sure. How many people flew during that expedition?
Well, we had four kites, and three were able to successfully launch, and one bounced.
Wow. Unbelievable.
He was a happy guy. He felt kind of ripped off, but he was real happy to be walking down, you know, safe and alive.
I'm sure. So it's a feat never before attempted, or never since as well.
Yeah. The year before that expedition, I was working with Ray Genet, and Buddy Woods was a friend of his who set the record with his helicopter of landing on the summit in 1976, right at the same time as the hang glider rescue was going on. There was another rescue happening. And so Buddy Woods and Ray were doing all that up there, but Buddy had been anxious to test that helicopter because he kind of figured he could get it to the summit, and that was really very much a record at the time. And so we were going to just try to do a surreptitious jump up there with a helicopter, fly off after I'd been acclimatized, because they could drop me off, then I could just jump, you know. And that didn't work out weather-wise and detail-wise and stuff to do that. So the next year we did that. And Buddy ended up flying his helicopter right to the summit right at the same time. But it was such a strange thing with the altitude and the lift and the controls that he actually hung a 5-gallon can of fuel off the nose of his helicopter. It was a Soloy turbine modification, Hiller, I think is what it was. It was controlling, strangely enough, that he had to change his trim by hanging a can of fuel off the nose of the helicopter. I mean, this is real Alaska stuff.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about the flight. Was it from the summit and then around back to one of the lower camps, or was it a flight all the way down? How much airtime did they get?
Yeah. Well, you know, originally what we wanted to do, we were actually thinking about trying to fly off to the north, just because there's really an unimpeded and fairly short drop all the way down to a lot of lower elevation. But the logistics of that were just too grim. I mean, when it came down to it, if anything had happened along the way, the helicopters or planes weren't allowed in that portion of the park at the time. So we ended up flying off to the south. And, the intention, again, was to fly as far as you could. But then expediency just dictated to land at base camp, because we didn't have the helicopters to pick up the pilots off of a glacier crevasse field, as an example. So you'd never really be quite sure where you were going to land. So they made the landing strip on the southeast fork of the Gilton of the Goal. And the interesting thing was, is Bob Burns, the first guy off, the guy that went into the flat spin and said, I almost died. Well, he got a little freaked out. And remember, he only had a few minutes of airtime in that kite. So, and he was so high that he can't get any visual reference as to movement at all. He was so high in the air that there was no reference that the kite was actually in flight, or whether it was had any forward motion at all, because he was so high and he just couldn't see. I mean, you just weren't close enough to the ground to detect any actual change. And it freaked him out. So what he did was he crawled into the control bar. Normally they'd be flying prone, laid out. in a harness. And so what he did is he crawled into the control bar and sat in the triangular control bar underneath the kite, and it put the kite into a shallow dive because he was just freaked out and he was headed for the ground. So he put the thing in a shallow dive, and it took him about 45, 50 minutes or so to get down to base camp from the summit, just in a laser shot right down to that. And so that was the first flight. The second flight was completely different. Kent Hudson and Ed Kovalik were the two pilots who did that after Butch Wade crashed. And they went up after this was all done, had optimal weather conditions. They actually had a wind coming up off the football field, basically onto the summit there, and were able to soar above the summit as they flew off. So they were up a few hundred feet or a couple hundred feet above the mountain itself. And they had a little bit more presence of mind as to what was going on at the time and relaxed. It took about 2.5 hours to fly down to base camp.
What was it like just being there, seeing your expedition teammates soaring, you know, up? Is that a record? Was it a record at the time? Does it continue to be a record?
It was a record at the time. It was later on changed. There was a flight off of Aconcagua, I think, in South America that was, you know, around 23,000 feet, 22.9, something like that. And then there have been things that have happened in Nepal such since. But it was a record at the time. And here on this continent, it'll not likely ever be repeated, because right after that, the Park Service banned all hang gliding in all national parks. So it was just a done deal. And I'm afraid that we may have killed it. So we tried, you know, we tried to be as safe as we could, but that's just the way it worked.
Well, you got it while you could.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, the interesting thing too about watching, I didn't get a chance to watch. What happened was, is we tried to move a camp to 19-4 or so, where Archdeacon's Tower is. And that's quite high. I don't know that anyone's ever really had any kind of a long-term camp above Denali Pass at about 18-2. And so we tried to do that, and four of us made it to Archdeacon's Tower with camp gear and camp weight and you know, the other things like that. And the rest of the people just hit an altitude limit. They just couldn't do it. So we ran out of gas at that point in time. And at the same time, Bob Burns, with this little ham radio that he had, contacted Elmendorf Air Force Base for a weather report. So we're up at 19-4, and it's just dead calm, and it's beautiful, clear blue skies, and you know, it's a little cold, but it wasn't really bad. And he gets his weather report that says the jet stream is going to dip down on the upper portion of the mountain and bring in winds of 100 miles an hour. And we look off to the west, and we can see this series of clouds coming really fast from the west, with these upswept curling clouds in front of it, like it's really got a push behind it. So we're not only hearing this really bad news weather report, but we're also seeing this stuff coming. So we're going, oh man, here we go again. So we had to drop back down to 17, pick up the stragglers along the way that were just kind of exhausted on the trail and kind of hanging out in tents, kind of waiting for something to happen. I don't know, but we got back down to 17. And at that point, we had a team member who was starting to get sick, and he just had an altitude limit effect. He just wasn't able to eat, wasn't able to keep any food down. And he was starting to get dehydrated, and he was starting to get weak. And so that's bad news. So he had to go down. And at the same time, my wife and I went down, because we had another expedition. I got another guided climb coming along right behind that. And one of myself or Gary Bocard, who was my co-guide on that, one of the other of us had to go down and get this other expedition going. So my wife and I took Bruce down, and Bruce Hickok, and down, and we missed it. So I didn't, all the stuff that was happening on the summit with all the rescues and all the crashes, I was on a phone in Anchorage at Clean Fun Kites, in a conference call with the National Park Service and Roger Derryberry, who was our cinematographer, up on the summit of the mountain. And we're in this whole conference call over rescue stuff and who's going to do what. And no one at the time knew that Buddy Woods could fly his helicopter to the summit. And there was an all-women's team that had had an accident on the South Buttress that all happened all at the same time. So these guys are up on the summit, and these ladies show up and say that we've got two teammates down below that are injured. And so all of a sudden, and then Butch Wade crashes down the south face, and then so all of a sudden we've got all this happening at the same time. And so strangely enough, I was on one of the weirdest conference calls between the summit of Denali and then the Ranger headquarters in Healy, and then Anchorage, trying to figure out what in the world we were going to do. Huh. And so we organized a rescue with the Rescue Coordination Center from Elmendorf to drop in accios and ropes and other things that we were going to need to be able to get these people off the South Buttress in a traditional rescue, which is bad news at high altitude. I mean, it's just hard to do. And in the meantime, the RCC drop the rope and drop the Akios down below the summit, and they got lost. No one ever could find them, and so that all that just was a non-event. And that's when Ray Genet jumps in and says, "Hey, you know, Buddy Woods will take me to the summit. I'm fit. I've been up to the summit just recently," and he just jumps in and goes, and that's how that all worked out. But it was one of the strangest moments on the summit of Denali in its history. There's a guy, Jim, who's a manager at REI, you know, down in Colorado, who just happened to be coming to the summit at the moment of the second flight. So he came up to the summit on his climb of Denali right at the time that Kent and Ed were going to fly on that second flight, and actually helped them wire walk their kites and get them out and get them launched and stuff like that. But that's bizarre. I mean, that's just not normal at all.
Nothing normal about the hang gliding trip on Denali.
No, you know, and we were surrounded too by people falling off the mountain. People were falling off the mountain like flies, and the reason why was because the weather was so good. Everyone was going as fast as they felt, and they were going too fast, and they weren't acclimatizing properly, and so you're having really good, experienced technical climbers like the Austrian Mountain Rescue or Mountain Troops group. That just went up very quickly, and suddenly they're comatose with high altitude problems, cerebral edema, pulmonary edema, and requiring rescue. So we had rescues right and left of other groups all at the same time during this time, and actually the whole summer went rescue. There were a whole bunch. I can't remember how many, but there were a number of major rescues that happened that year, and a lot of it had to do with the weather. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that at that point in time, the rumor had gotten around that the Park Service was going to pay for all the rescues. So I think people were taking risks and doing things that they normally might not have done, thinking that there was a safety net that hadn't been there before. So there was a real interesting dynamic in the shift of Denali and its policies and people's attitudes toward rescue and risk right at that year. And it all kind of happened all at the same time.
Excellent. Jim, tell me about your book, An Alaskan Life of High Adventure. How much of this book takes place during the summer that you just described, and how much of it is outside of that?
Well, one of the chapters, of course, is about the hang glider expedition, because it was just such a notable event in itself. But the book basically chronicles my being born and raised in the territory of Alaska. It was prior to statehood. And so my parents moved up here in 1949, and I was born in 1953. And then Alaska became a state in 59. But back then, the whole state of Alaska, or the territory of Alaska, had less than 100,000 people in it. It was truly wild and wilderness. I mean, not a lot of game regulations. You could fly and hunt on the same day. There were fish and game were astounding, and the number of people. Well, you know, as an example, you climbed an alley, and in 1974, on my first climb, we saw 15 people the whole trip. We saw two groups, one Czechoslovakian group and one group that included Roger Robinson, who's a local ranger here. That's when I first met Roger, was up at Denali Pass in his group. But those were the only people that we saw. We had the mountain almost literally to ourselves. And you had to be completely self-sufficient because there was no one to call and there was no radio system that would really work well unless you were up at high altitude with a big, heavy, clunky radio telephones. And you pretty much had to be self-sufficient. And it was like being out on the high seas or out in a vast desert. It was just complete isolation. And the last time I climbed Denali, I came back in 2005 to climb with my two sons and my niece, Missy Leaf, from here in town. And we were on the summit with 80 people. And it was a great experience. It was one of the most amazing social experiences I've ever had, with a dozen nationalities and wading out weather at 14,000 feet, doing talent shows and all these other different kinds of things, and just, you know, killing time, having frisbee, ultimate frisbee competitions, and all the stuff that you do while you're waiting around. But the dynamic of Denali changed so much. So the book talks about that a little bit, you know, because Alaska was changing so much. And then I got a chance to ride along. So I got a chance to see this stuff and experience this stuff back when Denali was kind of more like the Wild West. I mean, the Park Service hadn't hardly even developed any kind of regulations. And so as guides, we were helping them develop the standards that would then go on and help them do their job later on in life. But it was pretty wild. So the book chronicles a whole pile of different things that happens. It talks about all the growing up in Alaska with all the earthquakes and avalanches and plane crashes and some good landings, some bad landings. My brother and his wife and an unborn child were killed in a plane crash down on Baranof Island in 1982. Just kind of typical Alaska, small plane, bush flying, bush living, hunting, fishing, climbing, hang gliding type stuff. So that's what the book's all about.
Well, it looks like an excellent read, and it does have a pictures section, which for me, you know, not being big on the books, does have a large section of color photos, including the Denali Hang Glider Expedition, some really fantastic nature shots.
Yeah, that's a shot that from Cahilton Pass, about 11,000 feet, and it's called, I called it Too Fat to Fly. We had a raven that hit a food cache there at 11,000 feet, and he got so loaded up on food that he was too heavy to lift off. And so I came along right at that point in time, just after he had flown. And those wing tracks that are in the snow that are highlighted by the alpenglow and the setting sun in the background, you can see where the raven hit, 10 or 12 times, trying to get in the air and hopping and flapping his wings. And so you've got these wing prints in the snow. And this funny thing about it is in the background, there's a foot trail down there. It looks like he finally stopped and walked, but I think he actually finally got in the air. But he was so heavy, and with the altitude, he had a hard time lifting off.
Fantastic. Promises to be one heck of a slideshow and a very interesting read. Jim Hale, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thanks.
And I look forward to hearing more stories in the future.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Thank you.